Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on the program a little bit later today, the coin circulation problem during the pandemic. But up front, the COVID-19 pandemic of the last 6 months has kept many workers at home, either working from home, putting in fewer hours, or losing their jobs completely. Efforts to contain the spread of the virus have changed how we live and work completely. For example, one of the most important mitigation strategies is we're told to stay at home from work when we're sick. For many workers who have sick leave, that means not getting, or don't have sick leave, I should say, that means not getting paid. That scenario is one of the reasons Governor Tom Wolf wants the legislature to approve paid sick and family leave time for all Pennsylvanians. However, there are objections to sick and family leave, especially now when many employers have been hit hard financially by the pandemic. We're going to hear several opinions on sick and family leave on today's program. Up front, we're joined by Democratic State Senator Maria Collette of Montgomery County. She has sponsored a sick and family leave bill. Senator Collette, welcome to the program.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or a comment you'd like to weigh in on sick and family leave, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Senator, what would your legislation do?
So it's actually, I the intro that you gave was really very timely here, and this is a state-managed insurance fund. It's going to provide family leave benefits to working Pennsylvanians that need time off to care for an elderly parent, for example, themselves in the event of a serious health condition, to care for an ill child or a close family member with a serious health condition. And this would also help to care for family members in the military in qualifying exigent circumstances. So the difference this program is that it is an employee-funded program, and it would really just sort of be there when our employees, our hardworking employees, need to take time off for a serious medical condition. Only 14% of the U.S. workforce has access to any type of paid family leave, and that's a problem. We know that many of our rural Pennsylvania residents that are in the lowest, wage earner categories don't have access to that paid family leave, and just 6% of people in low-wage jobs get paid family leave benefits, while 22% in top sector earning jobs do have it. So there's an incredible discrepancy there, and we want to sort of even the playing field a little bit so that every worker, in the event that they have a medical issue, has the ability to take time off and still get paid and have their job secured.
Two terms you use that I'd like you to identify. You said state-managed, and then you also said employee-funded. Let's start with state-managed. What do you mean by state-managed?
Sure. So this would be managed through the Department of Labor and Industry, the Pennsylvania Department of Labor and Industry. The payments that are made by the Pennsylvania worker would go right to this fund. It would be managed. We had a really wonderful, robust hearing January of this year in the Senate Committee on Labor and Industry, and Julia Grubbs, who is the Deputy Policy Director for the Pennsylvania Department of Labor and Industry, discussed administering a fund like this. And she had a chance to see how a state like Washington, for example, who started from scratch, just like we would be doing, how they implemented a very similar program. And she feels very confident that here in Pennsylvania, we could do the same and make sure that money is getting to people when it needs to.
So employee funded, does that mean that there would be deductions from an employee's paycheck that would go into this fund?
Yes, but they are incredibly small deductions. So we're talking about 0.588% contribution, 59 cents on every $100. So when we talk about an average Pennsylvania household income of $78,000, and that's according to the most recent census data that we have, that means that on average, that household is paying $8 a week into this program. And, that really is a small price to pay to ensure that when someone needs to care for an elderly parent or care for themselves in the event of a health condition, that they have the ability to do so while still earning money at home.
What about the employer's role? Because we're going to talk about whether this would cost employers. What is the employer's role? What is the employer's cost?
So the employer's role is really that they would, just like in FMLA, we already have that federal FMLA program, just like FMLA, they would secure the job for the worker while the worker is on their paid family leave. So, you know, as part of that hearing I discussed earlier, we had Alex Halper. He's the Director of Government Affairs for the Pennsylvania Chamber. And he spoke about this bill, and he said, you know, he really does appreciate the intent behind Senate Bill 580, especially because when we sat down to craft it, we really tried to do our best to highlight the concerns that the chamber has in terms of representing businesses in our Commonwealth. There were concerns about those direct and indirect costs to implement it. And, you know, that, again, falls to the state agency. And, you know, I have to say that, you know, Mr. Halper's testimony really did begin and end on very encouraging notes. He emphasized that this particular bill is very thoughtfully drafted. It addresses employer concerns. And I really left our hearing feeling very hopeful that we were moving closer to consensus on a bill like this. And I am still hopeful, and I'm excited that the governor is taking this up as part of his initiative for the fall. And I think we have crafted a really good bill here that helps businesses and workers alike. And it's something that I think we can get across the finish line.
And we're going to hear from the Pennsylvania Chamber of Business and Industry in just a few minutes. Right now, you mentioned this hearing was in January. That was pre-pandemic. Probably people were looking at, and I'm entering my own opinion of observation in here. People were probably looking long term at that point, not knowing that we had a pandemic coming up. One of the things that has been said now that we are in this pandemic is that the time is just not right. Now, I know you're going to make the argument that the time is perfect because you don't want people going to work sick, that kind of thing, but that businesses are saying, you know, we have a number of businesses, especially small employers out there, that are just getting by, and many will not survive. What do you say to that?
So, again, this is not an employer-funded program. So those businesses that are struggling, and believe me, I am incredibly sympathetic to that, and I have I have been very vocal to our governor and to the administration about making sure that we are getting businesses back on track, because we all know that small businesses are the backbone of our economy here in the Commonwealth. So, you know, I really would say to that, you're right. The hearing we had was pre-pandemic. Everything has shifted. Our thoughts have changed over the course of the last couple of months. But, you know, the business cost to train a new employee really far outweighs the ability for that employer to have that trained, good, quality employee come back to work healthy and not infecting anyone else in their workforce. So I would say that, you know, there are things we have to weigh on both sides of this. And you're right, I am going to make the argument that in this time, there is a really critical need for people to be able to stay at home when they need to. We're talking about small businesses that have loyal, trained employees. Businesses don't want to lose them. This bill came to me after a meeting I had with two constituents of mine, two young people who were, you know, working people. They were working in the cake decorating industry, and a young man who was working as a landscaper. And they came to me because their infant daughter was born with a congenital heart defect, and she only lived for a short few months. But in that time, they wanted to spend every moment that they could with her, not worrying about whether or not they could pay their mortgage and pay their bills. And unfortunately, for that family, the mother was able to spend a lot of time with her little girl before she passed. But the father was working, making sure that the bills were paid, making sure that the mortgage was intact. And these were people that had a really good support system in terms of family. All I'm saying is that we here in the Commonwealth recognize how important our small businesses are and how incredibly loyal and valuable our good employees are. And we want to make sure that, you know, the argument was made during that hearing from the Small Business Association that, you know, small businesses are like a family, so we want to make sure that our family members are treated, you know, as good as we can treat them, and make sure that our family members are coming back to us whole, robust, ready to work again and ready to contribute that 100% that they were giving prior to whatever health issue occurred in their lives.
Right now, there are 8 states and the District of Columbia that have similar legislation that has become law, second family leave. Have you seen experiences in those states, good and bad?
Absolutely, and largely good. You know, what we're seeing from those businesses is what we thought we would see, that businesses are able to attract employees because these small businesses are able to realize that they can offer something that larger corporations have always been able to offer at their own cost. So, you know, when we talk about essential workers, right, we say you're essential. We need you. Our economy needs you to continue to function. The people in our communities need you to continue to function. Let's show it. Let's show those people that we believe them to be essential and treat them as we would essential employees. It's really as basic as that. The states that have implemented this, and including Washington, D.C., have seen that employees have benefited, businesses have benefited, and there hasn't been some of this sort of calamity that we talk about when we talk about, like, oh, my goodness, what is this going to do to businesses if suddenly people are able to exercise, you know, family leave in the event of a medical emergency. Remember, this program is going to be administered by an agency that is really looking to make sure people have the appropriate documentation, that their doctors are really indicating that, yes, this is indeed the kind of circumstance that someone would need family medical leave for. So this is not just a program willy-nilly where every employee gets to choose whether or not he or she plans to come to work today. This is really something that is planned out just like FMLA. It is a program that is going to be administered and monitored and make sure that employee and employer alike are being treated fairly and that we are strengthening our workforce here in the Commonwealth, that we're making sure Pennsylvania can compete with every one of those states, with New Jersey and California and Rhode Island and Washington, all of those great states. We want to be able to compete by showing our workers that we believe them to be essential and treating them as such.
Democratic State Senator Maria Collette of Montgomery County, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks so much, Scott. It's my pleasure.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News. Your NPR News, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. I've only done this for 10 years now. We'll be back right after this. By the way, there's no Smart Talk tomorrow or Monday, the holiday, Labor Day, but we do return Tuesday with a discussion of 5G technology and also the 17-year cicada that's coming up on Tuesday's program. Well, you just heard from a senator who supports sick and family leave. One of the big issues is cost to employers, and Senator Collette kind of downplayed that issue. But now we're going to hear from Gene Barr, president of the Pennsylvania Chamber of Business and Industry. Gene Barr, welcome to the show.
Hey, Scott, how you doing?
I'm doing well. If you have a question or comment, and by the way, we got a couple other comments during Senator Collette's appearance on the show that I'll pass along. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Gene Barr, what do you think about what Senator Collette is proposing? And there are other sick and family leave bills as well.
You're absolutely right. There are a larger number of bills that are kicking around out there, and she did focus on one thing, which I think is critical. I think her comment was that she noted that, you know, larger companies, larger corporations have already done this. So I think it absolutely does focus us down on the fact that we're now looking at smaller businesses here. And she was right. I mean, in terms of what she noted about what the chamber has said, Alex Halper from the staff here has testified, and we've looked at this, and we'll certainly be willing to have discussions about this. There are some issues that need to be resolved, not the least of which is, will the legislature be willing to implement a personal income tax hike as part of this? You know, in the past, they've been reluctant to do that for a number of different reasons on a number of different issues. But this really is one. This whole concept of discussing kind of mandated paid leave is really one that focuses down on smaller businesses here.
Well, something you just said, hike the personal income tax. You know, Senator Collette did not use that terminology, and the terminology I've seen is a payroll tax. But what you're saying is it amounts to a personal income tax.
Well, she noted, she said employees would pay it. The only way for employees to pay it would be either a separate tax that would be created, or I believe she said a 0.5% increase in the personal income tax. Currently, the personal income tax in PA is 3.07. Hers was between 0.5 and 0.6, as I recall, I believe, in the bill.
Mm-hmm. So there would be a personal income tax hike, and there would be additional money taken out of a worker's paycheck. What about to employers? Would there be a cost to employers?
Well, look, the cost to employers would be trying to make sure that they cover that shift. There could be overtime that's there. And again, the cost, and you know, we appreciate Senator Collette's approach to this, the cost would be a little bit, you know, would be minimized under her approach because, of course, employees would be paying into it. Some of the other proposals that we see do impose certainly cost upon employers. As she noted, larger corporations, by and large, already provide paid sick leave. Of course, we have federal Family and Medical Leave Act. This is one that would hit smaller businesses, and we know that there's a bill that's been introduced in the legislature. The governor has called for this as well. But we're uncertain of whether or not this would be, you know, is it under 10 would be exempted, under 50, under 5? Are there no exemptions? Because, of course, you know, once we do this, and some of the leave aspects in the bill that we've seen are fairly broad. For example, it's to take care of someone with whom you have basically a family-type relationship. Who defines that? How do we define what a type of family relationship is? The issue of serious condition has expanded at the federal side as well over the years. So businesses would have to hire, if someone is out, they'd have to hire someone else to do that. It could involve overtime costs and could involve training costs. And again, I think it's important to note, which you and Senator Collette did talk about, we're talking about this now in the middle of a pandemic. As I walk around Harrisburg, increasingly we're seeing more businesses shutting down here. We're seeing more restaurants shutting down. This will hit hard, and this, of course, comes on top of calls to increase the minimum wage to $15 or more from some people per hour. So if you're a small business and you're literally struggling to survive and you're looking at this, how do you feel about, you know, more mandates? Our members have talked about the fact that mandates and government regulations are one of the most difficult things they have to deal with. I think we ought to be concerned about getting the economy up and running and then have these discussions about putting additional costs directly on business.
So I just want to clarify your position, the chamber's position on this. You don't necessarily right away say we oppose sick and family leave, but you are saying that right now, during the pandemic, is not the right time for this.
I think we have to do this. Whatever we do needs to be done thoughtfully. Senator Collette's is a thoughtful proposal. We have weighed in on it and said we can take a look at this and have further discussions about how it works. We have weighed in at the federal side to have discussions about how we make FMLA a little bit easier to administer. The other thing to keep in mind, of course, if we implement a state proposal, we've got right now that you have the family and medical leave aspects that have come in under the under federal legislation during the pandemic. You've had the existing FMLA. You've got a new paid family leave and sick proposal that the governor has put out there and a couple legislators have done. And on top of that, we have some local ordinances. It's going to be difficult for business at a time when, as I said, they're literally struggling to survive to navigate this. So I think, again, we have to be extremely cautious in what we move forward on during this time that is, from an economic basis, unprecedented in 80 or 90 years.
Okay. So, Gene, during this time is a very important part of this because the governor mentioned this earlier this week when he talked about it, but even Senator Collette mentioned it as well, is that we have a lot of people who are told, don't go to work sick. We're trying to mitigate the spread of the coronavirus. And especially a lot of lower-income people are doing that because they don't have, they can't take sick days. They don't have paid sick days. I mean, certainly you don't want people going to work sick. That's going to end up costing employers in the long run, not to mention the health aspects of it.
Of course not. No employer wants their employees sick, themselves sick, their customers sick. But of course, there's part of the federal legislation, part of the recovery, was to establish some of this paid sick leave for folks that are in that condition. But you're absolutely right. Those things need to be taken cautiously here, and I think we need to address those kinds of aspects during this time. I think it's a mistake to proceed without a whole lot of thinking, doing long-term labor law in the middle of a pandemic. And that's what, you know, as we've noticed, Senator Collette would do that with an employee tax, but some of the others simply put all those costs on employers. We need to be cautious about long-term policy costs being put on small businesses, particularly during this time.
Thomas sent an email, and this came in, admittedly, during Senator Collette's portion of the program, but I just wanted to get your take on it as well. Thomas says it's not the employer's obligation to pay sick leave mandated by the state. If there is a union that bargained for this, okay, but not the state. Once again, a government program that's set up not thinking of abuse, such as calling in sick, when sick, using sick days for vacation days, etc. What are your thoughts on that, Gene?
Well, look, that is one of the things that I think we have to be concerned about. You know, he's right. I mean, usually these are things when you look at you're a member of a bargaining unit, usually bargain for these. I know that some of the government unions are pushing for this as well. And, you know, interestingly, a couple of years ago, the union was seeking to keep their aspect, which would allow them to get paid for sick days that weren't used. And their comment was that people should support that because that gives them an incentive to come to work. So it seems like they're saying, we want to come to work and get paid even when we're sick, and you guys should support that. But then they turn around and say, we don't want people coming in sick. And yeah, we do have to be concerned about people taking advantage of this. And it's not going to be the majority there, but unfortunately, we're setting up a new program. Whether we fund that with employee dollars, of course, we have to be good stewards of individual taxpayers' dollars, or we, you know, there are people who want to put this solely on the backs of business. And you're absolutely right. As I said, we have people who want to craft an exemption for someone with whom they have a family type relationship. Those things get very ambiguous and very difficult to ascertain in a lot of times.
You know, I think both you and Senator Collette made the point that during the pandemic, things are a lot different. And you said that you are concerned about crafting long-term legislation during this time. But the case has been made that in the long run, this helps an employer's bottom line because they are able to retain employees. They don't have as much turnover. You have employees that aren't taking sporadic days off, and there is a cost to hiring and training new employees. What are your thoughts on that?
Look, that is one thing Senator Collette and I agree on. Getting good employees, attracting them and retaining them is one of the most difficult and important things that an employer can do. However, when you have government interject itself with a very prescriptive program that says your leave program shall look like this, in many cases that supersedes what many of my members have already done. Many have set up a program that works well for them. For example, I'm going to give you sick leave, but if you don't take it for the first 6 months, I will give you a bonus. I don't think they're going to implement a bonus program plus have to administer what the state has done. So, yes, you know, we hear this a lot with things like, well, you know, you should pay $15 or $16 or $17 an hour to help you retain your employees. And unfortunately, that often comes from people who've never been in business. Our folks know how to run a business. They know what it takes to attract and retain employees. If they don't, then shame on them. But it's rather interesting to hear that out of the government saying, we know what's best for you. We can dictate how you run your business. This would supersede many of the programs that are already out there if you don't fully prescribe and adhere to all the regulations that would come in under state law.
So you have a problem with the senator mentioned that this would be a state-administered program. I just want to clarify that that's one of the things that you do have an issue with?
Well, look, I mean, we can have the discussions about it. You know, you had noted that, you know, some of these programs can be liable for fraud and misuse, and I think you and I would agree on that. Not most, but I think we have to make sure that we don't do that.
That actually was a listener who made that point.
Right. I'm sorry. Yes. And that certainly can happen. But we're willing to have discussions about, this employee run. You know, we have not said we're adamantly opposed. We're certainly willing to have those discussions. The bigger concern is when the entire cost of the program is going to be borne by business, and in this case, it's going to be small business, hoping to emerge from a pandemic. I mean, look, there's a lot of discussion about employees being retained by employers. If we don't get these employers to come back, it'll be an irrelevant discussion because we're going to have fewer and fewer employers who are going to be out there to hire people.
Hmm. Okay, so let's talk about that. I mean, under Senator Collette's proposal, and granted, there are a number of them out there that are different. But if there is very little cost to the employer, then what would the difference be for a business that is struggling right now because of the pandemic?
it could still put additional cost on in terms of potential overtime, in terms of other administrative costs, et cetera. You know, we'd have to look, and again, we expressed not opposition. What we've said is this is something that we could look at. Again, I think the big question is, can this come through as an increase in the personal income tax? Mm-hmm. Will that pass this legislature?
With Governor Wolf calling for second family leave earlier this week, this issue takes on a little more, it gets more attention and maybe even more importance in the legislature with several bills out there. What happens? Where do we go with this?
Well, it's a great question. Again, we are facing a very difficult fall here. I'm not sure the legislature is going to entertain this at a time when they're looking to close a multi-billion dollar shortfall in state revenues. I think that the our view is that the legislature needs to focus on what we need to do to get business back up and running, what we need to do to keep our people safe. And again, doing long-term labor policy in the middle of this, when we so desperately need businesses to get back, from our perspective, to do this with what the governor has proposed and certain other legislators has proposed is problematic. We have to be very cautious about any additional cost that we put on because it is very precarious position for so many businesses these days. I just don't know that the legislature is going to want to take this up at this point at a time, as I say, when all eyes are on the budget and what we're going to need to do to close that gap and continue to provide the services that we want out of state government.
And one final question, Gene, and I know I'm asking you to repeat yourself, but I'm just trying to clarify here so that everyone understands. Say the pandemic ends, and I know this is a dream, but ends soon, and things get back to relative normal. Would the chamber, would your members entertain some type of sick and family leave?
If it's a discussion about an employee funded that removes most of the financial burden from business, hate to say it that way, but we're going to be dealing from a business perspective with the economic results and fallout from this pandemic for many years. If that's what it is, we'll have a discussion about how we can craft a program that is effective. If it's one that simply says, hey, business, you're going to need to do that, that creates significant problems for us. And I believe, we'll continue to be a non-starter given that we've got FMLA, the residuals from, other federal legislation drafted during the recovery phases, state activity, as well as local ordinances. That becomes a real problem of overlay of government regulations, and we're going to be, look at that very cautiously and probably pessimistically. Senator Collette has come up with a proposal that, in our view, we can take a look at. But anything else that simply says business, you're going to have to pay more regardless of what you do now is problematic for us.
Gene Barrs, president of the Pennsylvania Chamber of Business and Industry. Gene, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott. Take care.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. The 2020 election, a pandemic, an ongoing protest. The country also faces stark political divisions. It's a hard time to bridge differences. On Monday, we'll hear from some who are trying to talk and to listen. Join us for One Small Step, Courageous Conversations Across a Growing Divide. That's Monday at 9 on WITF. Have you seen any of those signs outside retail businesses or maybe at the cash register saying, we need your coins? You may have heard there's a coin shortage during the COVID-19 pandemic. Actually, there was not a shortage of coin, but a circulation problem caused by several factors. Joining us to talk about this issue is Hannah Walker, Vice President of Political Affairs with FMI, the Food Industry Association, and a member of the Federal Reserve U.S. Coin Task Force. Ms. Walker, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott. Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, so I want to clear this up right up front. Coin shortage. That's how I've heard this described over the last couple months, that there was a coin shortage here in the United States. Is there a coin shortage?
Scott, that's a great question. And the easy answer is no. We've got about 48 billion coins out there in American households. We just need to get them moving again. The pandemic has changed people's lives, and we're not acting as we did back in February. And one of the weird effects from it is that we're not moving coins as we have in the past.
So what are some of the factors that has, you know, contributed to this circulation issue?
Sure. So when you think back, if we can remember that long ago in February, when you go to the grocery store, and you know that's who we represent at FMI, you might do several things. You might stop at the coin kiosk and drop off that jar of coins that you had sitting by your front door and redeem it or donate that to charity. You might stop by customer service and buy some stamps and then go through your regular shopping. Well, all of that changed in March, and we really saw a huge shift in how American consumers functioned. And one of the things that we saw was they changed how they shopped. You didn't go to the store and do all these ancillary things. Either you could be like me and just start ordering everything online, doing curbside or home delivery, and not go into the store. Or you could go to the store, and we saw our customers become much more mission-oriented. They went in, they got their four things, and left. They were not doing these other things in the store. Conversely, additionally, at the banks, right? Like, you might stop by your bank and bring your bag of rolled coins and, you know, do a few other banking things. Because of COVID, many bank lobbies closed or limited their hours and access. And the consumer wasn't doing what they did previously, and it really slowed down that circulation of coins that we're now dealing with today.
Why is this important? I mean, there are so many people using debit cards, credit cards to an extent, but debit cards for cash, or if they're using cash. Why is it important that there is a circulation issue?
Sure. So here in the grocery industry, again, that we represent, about $15 of every 100 that we accept in the store is cash. So we're still a very heavy cash-reliant industry. You also see that in convenience stores and, of course, vending and some other really cash-heavy industries. And that really reflects the American consumer. There's a large population of folks who are either cash-preferring or cash-dependent. They either lack access to traditional banking, so they do not have debit and credit cards, and cash is their one option of payment. We also have people who are cash preferring, whether it's for budgetary reasons or habit, they prefer to use cash over other payment forms. And in the grocery industry, we basically accept everything short of bartering. So we will take your debit and your credit card. We still have a large check business. Cash, and of course, your government benefits, a SNAP and WIC, we accept those as well. And that's really to serve the entire community, to ensure that those folks who are underbanked and or non-banked or cash-preferring are able to continue to function in commerce. But we have to be able to make change for them when they come in and want to use cash as a tender.
So you don't think bartering is in our future, like trading a chicken for a tomato or
yeah.
anything?
Unfortunately, they have discouraged bringing livestock into the grocery.
Probably a good idea nowadays.
Right. I think our food safety team would have some thoughts on that.
So let's talk about the task force that you're on, the Federal Reserve U.S. Coin Task Force. This came about this summer as a result of the coin circulation issue. Talk about the task force and what it is supposed to do and is doing.
Absolutely. So in mid-July, the Federal Reserve made an announcement that they were going to have to start allocating their coin supply to their customer banks. And we're kind of at the end of that chain in retail, and I was like, I don't exactly know what that means, but it sure doesn't sound good. And sure enough, within a few days, I started hearing from some of our retail members that they who get coins from their bank where they're a customer, we're hearing from their bank that they were not going to be able to get their full coin order fulfilled. So we reached out to our contacts at the Cash Policy Office at the Federal Reserve, and they shared with us that the slowdown had really created a huge problem in the supply chain. And we learned that about 80% of the coins that we rely on in the market today are actually recycled. So they're not newly minted coins. They're actually put back through the system. And so our conversation with the Fed, my question was, well, what are you going to do about it? And they said, well, what are you going to do about it? And why don't we? And that's when they suggested standing up this task force. And we're really excited to hear that they did that, because they brought in all the key links to the payment to the coin chain. So they brought in, of course, their bank customers and the bank trades. They also brought in the armored car carriers and the coin aggregators, so the kiosks you see in the front of the grocery, and retail. So we've all sort of, we're told to put our heads together and let's think about defining the problem, making sure we understand what the problem is, and how do we fix it? So we spent the first few weeks in July really looking at the coin supply chain and where those real speed bumps were, and that's when we really recognized it was in the U.S. consumer change in habit. And so what we did at the end of July was put out a public statement defining we have a coin circulation problem and it could be fixed by the U.S. consumer getting coins back into circulation and really calling on the U.S. customer to bring your coins in and use them for payment, bring them to a coin kiosk for redemption, or bring them to your financial institution for deposit or for redemption. That was sort of the easy work, right? Like, this is what we need the customer to do. The task force then moved into the hard work of, well, how do we make that happen? You know, again, the consumer has changed their habits. How do we make sure that we can accept these coins, encourage the acceptance of the coins, and once they're accepted, make sure that they're pushed back through the chain and not sitting in the back of the store in a bunch of bags? So we spent the month of August really coming up with what we call like toolkits for retailers and for banks to do coin drives and to do coin drives with their employees and their associates, and thinking of ways to do charity drives to bring more coins into the supply chain, but also thinking then, okay, once I get this bucket of coins, making sure I'm working with my armored car carrier to get them to the bank and making sure that the bank then is working with their carrier to get them to the Federal Reserve and getting them moving. So the task force has really done a lot of that thinking on the consumer-facing side, how do we get them to do it, but also on the industry side to make sure we can do it.
Let me tell our listeners that we only have about 10 minutes, and it's a fascinating topic. Maybe you've experienced something at a local retailer having to do with coins. Are you one of those people who have coins in that jar by the door or in the bedroom, wherever people store them? We'd like to hear from you. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are @smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Hannah Walker, you know, a lot of people probably just take coins for granted, just like we do cash. And you were talking about the mint just a few minutes ago. There probably are people asking, why don't the mint just make more coins? What is the life cycle of a coin?
Absolutely. And that was sort of my first question. I said, well, why doesn't the mint just make more coins? So when we looked at, when we actually started that conversation and working with the task force, we learned a lot. So the mint did slow down production early in COVID, right? Like, we all changed our lifestyle, so did the mint. But they have now ramped back up and they're at full production. But what we learned is the mint, even at full production, only can supply about 20% of our coin supply. And that the rest really comes from that recycled coin. And it's a fascinating behind-the-scenes thing that really the U.S. consumer and Hannah Walker never saw until we reached today. So, you know, as a consumer, I'll go in and I'll buy something and, you know, pay and, you know, give them a quarter and some nickels or whatever. At the retailer, what they typically do is then put all those coins together and go to their bank where they're a customer and deposit those coins. Well, actually, I would say they go. Their armored car carrier takes them to the bank for deposit. The bank then takes all of those coin deposits, including those from the consumer who might come in with their rolled coins, and send them to the Fed. And the Federal Reserve collects all of the coins from all of their customer banks, you know, sorts through them, makes sure they get rid of all the broken and, you know, damaged coins, and then fulfills the bank orders using a mix of freshly minted coins and recycled coins. And it works back the same channel it got there, right? So the armored car carrier gets it to their bank. The bank then supplies it to the retailer, who then makes change for the consumer. It's a really interesting ecosystem that we never knew even existed, at least I didn't as a consumer, until all of this happened. And what we learned was we weren't making those deposits to the banks, the consumer and the retailers. So the banks weren't making those deposits to the Federal Reserve, and the Federal Reserve's reserves drew down. So even as the mint has gone back to full capacity and running, you know, full steam ahead on their production, those deposits still aren't back up. And that's where we really have focused at the task force, is how do we get those deposits back up and the consumer pushing those coins back in.
Let's take a phone call from William in Lancaster. William, you're on the air.
Hi, I just had a quick comment about how my local Sheetz is handling the coin shortage. For about a month, I usually pay in cash, and any change I had under a dollar, I would get in the form of a gift card to Sheetz. So, you know, I had roughly half a dozen or a dozen gift cards, all about 90 or 75 cents a piece on them.
I actually experienced the same thing, William. I had my first one was 81 cents, so I had to remember I had that in the car. William, thank you very much for your phone call. Hannah, it sounds as if some retail businesses have had to get creative in how they're doing, but you know, the business he mentioned, Sheetz Convenience Stores, was one of the very first that I saw signs out front saying that we need your coins.
Absolutely. We've seen a lot of creative thinking on the behalf of retail. We're actually, you know, they're pretty good at that, thinking of outside the box. And we've seen those mitigation practices put into play, whether it's putting the change on a gift card, asking folks to round up to the dollar and donating that difference to charity. We've also seen where they'll put that onto your loyalty card. So if you are shopping at a grocery store frequently and you have a loyalty card, they'll often offer to roll that onto your loyalty card. So when you come back in, you've already got an 81 cent credit on your next transaction. Those are all great mitigation things. And it helps our guys be able to continue to accept cash and have the least disruption in operations. But we still have to focus on how do we get those coins back moving again as well.
I'm curious if you've heard this. In today's society, it seems as though everything is controversial. I have talked to people working in retail who have encountered customers who said that the coin shortage, as they call it, is just a conspiracy theory, that there is no coin shortage. Now, we've established there is not a shortage, but there is a circulation issue. Have you heard that? And what do you say to those people?
Oh, I've heard that in my own household.
Oh, really?
That this is the great conspiracy. We're using this time to finally get rid of the penny or get rid of change, and we'll just move, you know, to a coinless society. If that were the case, we'd put a lot of work into something that is, you know, into something that we're trying to get rid of. But absolutely not. First of all, for grocery, we are a pennies margin industry. So in the entire time that FMI has been tracking the profits of the grocery industry, we've never reached 2%. Typically, it's about 1.89% profit margin. So pennies really do count in grocery. So when we think about this, you know, conspiracy of getting rid of the coin, we're like, wait a minute, that has a huge impact on our industry and our operations. The other piece really is that there is a public policy debate, right, that has been ongoing about the coins and the use of coins and the viability of coins. I think if anything, this is really emphasized, first of all, you know, we often hear the cost of creating a penny is more than one penny. But when you look at the life cycle of a penny, that value of the penny is actually more, right? Like it gets used time and time and time again. So while we think it costs more to create a penny than 1 cent, it gets used so often that its value is much higher. Additionally, I think it's driven home again that we have cash-reliant people who actually need that change and rely on that change, and that if we start to even think about this in the public policy space, that this has greater impact than we would typically think about now, recognizing that we've got those cash-reliant individuals. So huge impact on our industry, huge impact on our customer, and that we now recognize the value of a coin is more than we ever thought before.
And following up on that, Terry asked, not quite the same as a coin shortage, but related, would result in the need for fewer coins. Any effort, thoughts on eliminating pennies? And he mentions Canada has done this.
Right. No, and particularly not at the task force. Our goal is to get coin moving and ensure that everybody in the supply chain has access to adequate coins. Pennies, quarters, nickels, dimes, all of them are, you know, treated equally in our concerns and definitely wanting to get out there. As I mentioned, you know, there has been that public policy debate, but I think this has really driven home that pennies matter right now and that people are counting their pennies. Retailers count their pennies. They still count.
You mentioned the recommendations that the task force has made to get more coin into circulation. And by the way, we have a link to your website with those recommendations if our listeners want to go to our website, WITF.org/smarttalk, and you can click on that and see the recommendations that have been made. But, you know, we're talking about those recommendations. You know, there are so many people. One thing we talked about the jar, but we haven't talked about hoarding. Why is it that so many people hoard? I mean, I find it as a way to save money, but that there are so many people hoarding coins, and maybe even more so now during this pandemic. You're saying don't hoard them. Bring them in. Cash them in. Do what you can right. to get them back into circulation.
Absolutely. I think, you know, I read a funny article or, you know, interesting article about a guy who just had been collecting coins for years and just had buckets in his garage. It took him and he had $5,000 worth of coins.
Wow.
I'm like, well, you should take a really good trip with that.
Yeah,
buddy.
Really.
So it is, I think, you know, I always sort of laugh at the idea of hoarding. Of what, at what point do you reach of like, I just haven't gotten into redeem them versus I've now become a hoarder, right? And I have a very large cache of coins. You know, we really want to encourage people to get them out there, get them moving. And part of what, you know, again, like so much of our recommendations have focused on is ensuring industry is making that easy for customers. And we don't in any way want to encourage people. If you've got a bucket of coins in your garage, we don't want you to feel embarrassed or bad about it. We want you to be like, hey, I'm helping here. I'm helping my neighbors and I'm helping this problem. Bring it in. So we want to make sure that we're ready when you come in with that bucket of coins, and we've got a way of accepting it.
Okay, now one thing you mentioned, bring them in. There are some banks, at least when things were normal, that you could take your coins in, dump them in the machine, and get you know, a little slip that you know, you could get cash back. But now there are those institutions out there that want your pennies, your quarters, your nickels, your dimes rolled before they don't want the loose change. That takes a lot of work, and especially if you don't know how many you have, what to get. So, you know, what do you tell people if they you know, your institution says they have to be rolled, we're not going to take this loose change?
Sure. So there's a few things there, and that's where the task force has really done a lot of thinking and work and creating these toolkits of opening up those lanes to be able to accept coins. And so, you know, some banks are in a position to be able to take loose coins. They've got the coin counters and the kiosks in their branches. A lot of banks don't have those anymore. And so they're really not in a place to do it. So we're like, okay, if you aren't able to accept loose coins, how can we get then the coin rolling kits out? Can you put these together and get them out to the consumer? But also use that as an opportunity for families to engage in the value of coins and maybe a way to keep your kids busy rolling coins. We undertook that here in our house recently and got a coin rolling kit, dug through the couch cushions, dug through everything, and rolled coins one rainy afternoon and then put it together and realized, you know, we had about $67 worth of coins we never knew we had. So we want to try and find ways for each consumer to be able to do this. And whether the bank is in a place to be able to take that bucket of loose coins, if not, what can they do to help their customer bring that in? The same thing in retail, right? Like if we've got that kiosk up front, make sure that it's, you know, open and ready and for you to bring that bucket of coins in. If we don't, can we find ways at customer service to accept those coins? And we certainly, you know, want to make sure that we're telling our customers about that. Like, bring your coins in. If we have coin counters in the store, we'll take loose coins. If we don't have a coin counter, we can supply you with those rolling kits.
Hannah Walker, Vice President of Political Affairs with FMI, the Food Industry Association, a member of the Federal Reserve U.S. Coin Task Force. Hey, Hannah, fascinating topic, and I'm going to get rid of my coins today, take them to, to the kiosk. Thank you very much.
Thanks for doing your part. Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow, join Rebecca Carroll for Come Through, featuring conversations about race.